I am Wallace, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina. There's quite a few of them sitting out there. I'm also very much in attendance at the Central Carolina group, and there's a few of those people sitting out there. But it's good to see all of you. It's good to be here in this meeting, and I'm nervous as a, and I won't say what I said earlier, but I'm about as nervous as I can get. I have never talked before a crowd this large before. I spoke up at Old Timers Panel in Akron 8 years ago, and I think it was about 5,000 in that auditorium, and I don't know how many is in here, but...
Yep. Speak a little closer, a little bit closer to the mic.
Whatever I say, it won't make no difference anyway, because the acoustics in here are not what they ought to be, and you're not going to understand everything I say anyway. I'm country, backward, ignorant, uneducated, and she's going to have trouble picking up what I say in order to sign it. I'm going to say things she's never heard before.
Step in there just a little bit.
It's good to be the newer member of the group today. Several times the last 2 or 3 years, I've been the old timer standing in North Carolina at the state convention because Dave C. would not participate. And it's mixed emotions when you're standing up behind people and they're having a sobriety countdown and you're the last one standing. That means that in all probability you're going to be the next one to go. And that's not a good feeling. I sure am glad that we got two today that's been here a little bit longer than I have. I'm not anxious to get on that bus just yet. You know, this is pioneers in AA topic, and I don't consider myself a pioneer in AA. I'm going to talk briefly about two or three people that are pioneers so far as I'm concerned in AA, and I'm truly grateful for what they've done. I remember in reading out literature that back in 1934, two well-known pioneers got together in Towns Hospital in New York. And that's when God and Bill Wilson got together and he had that spiritual experience. I'm also grateful that Ebby went to talk to Bill and that Bill listened to what he said, and as a result, it was very helpful in him getting AA started. You're going to see me wiping a little bit up here today. I can't help it. I have store-bought teeth. I'm on a medication that makes my nose run. And my wife calls it slobbering. But anyway, it's good to be here, and I'm grateful that those two people got together and that Ebby got together with them. And then eventually... Bill met up with Dr. Bob, and I'm truly grateful for the experience they had together, because without Dr. Bob responding to what Bill said, in all probability, we would not be here today. The identification process took place because Dr. Bob said that after Bill talked with him, that was the first guy that had ever talked with him about alcoholism that knew what he was talking about from personal experience. It did not come from book learning. I'm also grateful for a couple of other old-timers who has made it possible for me to be here today. I remember how that Warden Duffy started AA in San Quentin Prison in California. He called in AAs from Oakland and San Francisco to start meetings in the prison system, and some of the guys responded to it. I heard an old-timer from California tell me years ago that the people from San Francisco and Oakland were so enthusiastic about carrying the message in that they got in a fight in the parking lot. I wish that kind of enthusiasm existed in North Carolina. We do have some very dedicated volunteers there who go in on a weekly basis, and they do a tremendous job, but we need more. I'm also grateful for Alan Gill, a man in Raleigh, who was a member of the Hayes Barden Group. And in 1952, he was walking around Central Prison, and he talked to some of the guys that were in the honor grade, and he wondered how many inmates in Central Prison needed the program of recovery. And he went in and talked to the warden. And in 1952, he started AA in Central Prison. I'm grateful for those people because eventually I was ushered into the walls of Central Prison in 1963 with a sentence of 40 years in natural life at the expiration. That come about as a result of a crime that was committed after 4 days and 3 nights of complete blacked-out drunken insanity. And I had had a messed up life for many, many years as a result of my inability to manage my life. I was an alcoholic from the time I was 20 years old. And I know that in those early days of my drinking, I drank because I liked the effect produced by alcohol. Dr. Silkworth talks about that in the doctor's opinion. And I drank because I truly enjoyed the effect produced by alcohol. I remember that first night with that beautiful woman who enticed me to drink, how I felt. And she enticed me to engage in some activities I had never been involved in before. I'm grateful for those, too. But I know that that Sunday morning after the Saturday night that I took that first drink of booze with her, on Sunday morning I lay in bed. I don't want to sleep ever. I just want to relive Saturday night over and over again, thinking about every marvelous thing that had happened. And I knew that Sunday morning, as I lay in that bed fighting off sleep, I knew that Mom and Dad and my preacher brother had lied to me like dogs, telling me that booze was something that would send me to hell, and I had been in hog heaven on Saturday night. I had enjoyed everything, and I knew I'd be buying whiskey the next weekend, and I did. And that became a habit. And very, very quickly, rather than it becoming a habit, it became an obsession. And I began to drink and get in trouble. And over the next several years, I lost jobs as a result of my drinking. I lost driver's license from North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia as a result of my drinking and driving under the influence. I went into the Army in 53. I was drafted, and I got out in 55, honorably discharged, but I went back in 56. I went back in because of problems I had. Losing jobs, driving under the influence, driving out for license revoke. I also went back in because of running from problems. I had lots of problems. Old saying around home, where I was born and raised, that children in the back seat can cause accidents. Well, I learned that accidents in the back seat can cause children. In addition to being allergic to alcohol, I'm allergic to shotguns. I got married, and 3 months later, I was en route to Korea. And I stood on the deck of that ship. I made up my mind that in Korea, I would not drink. I was going to get my life straightened out. 5.5 months after landing in Korea, the Korean War was over. This is 56 and 57. 5.5 months later, I was promoted to sergeant. I had gone back in through the National Guard as corporal. That Saturday afternoon, I was promoted to sergeant, and I went down to the NCO club to buy my friends some drinks. And down at the club, alcoholism talked to me, and I began to listen to it. And I figured after 5.5 months of dryness, I could handle a beer. I made that mistake of drinking some beer and then getting a double shot of old Granddad and Coke. And that began a series of events that eventually brought me before the company commander. Because on Saturday night, I don't recall getting back to the barracks or on Sunday night either. I remember drinking on duty on Monday, and it wasn't long before I was a corporal again. And I made it back to the States. And in States, my alcoholism continued with me from Korea. And some year and a half or 2 years later, I was booted out of the Army at Fort Lee, Virginia, because of my inability to soldier and to be the type of guy that I had been in Korea when I did not drink. And I was booted out with an undesirable discharge. Went back home to live with Mom and Dad. They said no drinking. And 5.5 months later, dryness. I had not drank. They had introduced me to a lady that was to be my second wife. Wife number one had, and I had separated when I got back from Korea. They introduced me to her, and after 5.5 months of dryness, she thought she had me saved. And we got married. And we went to a dance 3 weeks later. At that dance that Saturday night, I got up and tried to dance, and I couldn't dance. And her friend invited her to go to the paddle room with her, and that friend's husband worked in the mill with me. And he handed me a glass of old Granddad. And I can tell you, when wife number two got back from that paddle room, I was ready to dance. And I thought I was doing pretty good till somebody stepped on my hand. That night, when the dance was over, they had to wake me up at the back of the room where I'd passed out. And for the next year, I put her through an awful lot of hell as a result of my inability to stop drinking. I didn't want to stop drinking, but I wanted to stop having all the trouble that I had had. I didn't get caught for drunken driving that year we were married, but I sure did get caught for drunken walking. And I just couldn't stop. I could stop for a few hours or a day or a few days, but I'd go right back. And after Christmas of 1963, I had been drinking for the most part. I'd worked enough to get money to buy my booze with. But the third weekend of January in 1963, after 4 days and three nights of drunkenness, blacked out insanity, crimes were committed that brought about my arrest the next morning. And that was January 21st of 63. And on February the 11th, being unable to defend myself as a result of being on a blackout, the lawyer Mom and Dad hired could not defend me. We stood mute. And then he asked the sheriff to present the evidence. The sheriff said that Monday afternoon he was in his office and he looked out and he saw me drunk on the street. He knew me quite well. He said he was coming out to arrest me, but the phone rang across the street. He went over to answer the phone. His secretary was not working. And he said he talked on the phone about a minute, and he came back to the door to see where I was, and I was gone. And I've wished him a million times that he had arrested me that Monday afternoon, because crimes were committed within 2 hours that brought about my arrest the next morning. I was placed in jail. No bond was allowed. And on February the 11th, when I stood in Superior Court, the judge listened to what the sheriff said, and then he told me to stand. And he said, "Young man, for the offenses committed, I hereby sentence you to the North Carolina Department of Correction for a period of 40 years and natural life at the expiration." And when they ushered me into the walls of Central Prison, I should have been frightened. I had never been in prison before, but I had been in jail many, many times. And I didn't know what to expect, but after being in there for a few days, I was given an assignment to Central Prison, and I was to work in the classification section. And then in June, two things happened that stand out in my mind. Three is, one, I got fired from the good job I had. A man was in the house when my wife, number two, got home from work on Monday morning, and she was assaulted, kidnapped, and robbed. I also went to a crazy meeting called Alcoholics Anonymous, June of 63. Next 8 months, I attended meetings, sat in the back of the room. I didn't do anything to get sober. I continued to do what I was doing, drinking the bottles of alcohol smuggled from the hospital, taking some of those outside issues that was being smuggled in by free people who wanted to make additional money. And on February 16, 1964, I came to in my cell block one Sunday night. I couldn't take life any longer. I had no future. Never would I get out. I couldn't think about the past. I couldn't tolerate the present. Suicide was the only thing that made sense to me. And I said, tonight would be a good time. And I took everything that I had and stood at the cell block door, knowing that that door would open that night at 9 o'clock. And I stood at that door after taking everything that I had under that pillow that night. And that door was to open at 9. I knew it would open at 9. And I was totally committed to stepping out onto the catwalk and plunging over the railing head first to the concrete below. You can call it sickness, blacking out, or passing out, or whatever you choose to call it. I choose to believe a loving God gave this alcoholic another chance. I came to with my head in the commode, vomiting and crying and praying, and I passed out. Came to late and crawled in bed. And the next morning, when I went out of the cell block to go to the breakfast and to my jobs, the inmates said to me, what was going on in there last night? I had been in the cell alone. I said, what are you talking about? They said, last night you cried out loud enough for everybody to hear you on this road. God, if you help me get back to AA, I'll try. I went back to AA. Some 2 weeks later, a real pioneer of Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a copy of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me what I needed to do with it, to take it to my cell block. And I can tell you that that alcoholic rehabilitation officer had 7 years of sobriety at that time in AA. Today he has 58. He has been a real pioneer in AA. And I'm talking about that lovable, that knowledgeable, that caring, that wonderful guy that has carried a message all the way from Canada, all over this nation, into Ireland and Scotland and various other places. And many, many of you out there, if you know who he is, Tom I, if you've heard him speak, raise your hand. He's a guy that has helped thousands. And those of us who are indebted to him will always be indebted to him. And most of you have probably already heard that he is having a problem now. And that in all probability he won't be traveling anymore. But if he never ever helps another alcoholic, he has done his share to help those of us who have found a way of life through his guidance and inspiration and caring and knowledge. And I'm grateful to him. He is one pioneer I am indebted to because he saved my life and helped me get in a place where I have had the most marvelous life I have ever had in my life. He is certainly a pioneer in AA, and I love him, and I know you do too. I love you people because you have meant so much to me down through the years and in many places that I have gone. I have a lot of friends in this group that I've met all over this nation, and I love you. and I'm hoping to make new friends today. I'm not out to be a pioneer in AA, but I want to stay here as long as I can. I don't want to get on that bus. I am ready to do whatever God allows on my heart to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, to be a maximum of service to Him and the people about me. I love you.
Thank you, Wallace. That was outstanding. Our next speaker is Gloria. She has 57 years of sobriety, and when we were talking before, she told me she had met Bill Wilson. I said, well, no matter what you talk about, I want to hear about you shaking Bill's hand and meeting Bill Wilson. So here's Gloria.
My name is Gloria, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. You know, when you get sick and tired of being sick and tired, when you get tired of living in the darkness of your soul, the emptiness of your life, when you feel lost and don't have any direction, when you come to the end of self-will, there I found an open door. That open door for me was a fellowship and a program of Alcoholic Anonymous. And for that, I am eternally grateful. I'm grateful for all the people that I met along the way that taught me and guided me into this new way of life. But I remember that first time that I got acquainted with this program, I knew nothing about Alcoholic Anonymous. 57 years ago, I had never, ever heard of Alcoholic Anonymous. At that time, they didn't even call alcoholism a disease. I was a nurse, and in nursing school, they never taught us anything about alcoholism. They said, the drunks, they live down on Skid Row. And that was the only knowledge they gave us about this disease. So in my ignorance, when I found myself with my life getting out of control, I didn't know what was the problem. I thought maybe I was losing my mind. I didn't know nothing else to think. So I sort of got rid of everybody out of my house because I really believed they were my problem. And if I get rid of them, I get rid of my problem. So I was living in this house all by myself one night, and I was sitting on my couch, and I was really in a stupor and sad because my life felt so empty that I had separated and lost the people that I love the most. And that particular night, while I was sitting there, I heard a song that came over the radio. And that song was The Love of God. And this guy kept saying, there's someone out there that need to hear this tonight. And I'm going to play it again for them. And he played The Love of God. He played that song about three times, and so I got up to find out what station that radio was on, and my radio wasn't even on. So I knew then that I had a serious problem. I had lost my mind. So I decided to pick up the telephone, and I called the operator. And I said to that person that answered the operator, I said, I have a problem and I need help. That lady said nothing to me on that telephone. She didn't ask me what I needed. but that lady connected me to the central office of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I have no doubt that this program is spiritually endowed, because that was certainly a spiritual intervention for me. But didn't know what this was when this lady got on the phone and she started asking me serious questions like, what is your name? Well, I immediately got suspicious. I say, they done connected me to the nut house and they're going to come and get me, so I better be careful what I say. So then when she asked me for my telephone number, I knew that it was all over, so I wouldn't give her my number. I gave her my mother's number. Now, I hadn't been at my mother's home in several weeks, but after that telephone call, I went to sleep and forgot all about it. And about 3:30 in the morning, I woke up and I thought, well, it'd be a great idea for me to go over and have dinner with my mother. You know, she'd be glad to see me at 3:30 in the morning for dinner. So I walked all of those blocks to her house. And when she opened the door, she thought something seriously had happened to me. But I went in the house and went into her bed and went to sleep. And, you know, the next morning she woke me up and she said, you got a telephone call. I say, how could I have a telephone call? Didn't nobody know that I was here? I didn't know that I was here. So now who could be calling me? She came back and she said, it's a lady and her name is Ida. And she said she's from Alcoholic Anonymous. And I suggest you get up and answer that phone. So when I went to the phone, the lady kept telling me about this meeting, you gotta go to this meeting. So I thought, well, maybe it must be an Avon meeting. And to get off my back and get off the phone, I agreed to go to this meeting. I thought if I go there and buy whatever she was selling, I'd be rid of it, you know. And so that lady that night, she showed up and she took me to this meeting. And I thought, well, now I find out what they're selling at this meeting. She took me to my first meeting of Alcoholic Anonymous. Again, I had never, ever heard of Alcoholic Anonymous. I had never heard about the disease of alcoholism. So when I went there and these people start talking to me, and at that particular meeting, and it's so wonderful to look around this room today and see all these beautiful people, because it was nothing but three women at that first meeting that I attended of Alcoholic Anonymous that was in the group of AA at that time. And one of the ladies, she had a slip. So she came up to me and she was sort of shaking. She said, you keep coming back and you'll get what I got. Now, I didn't know if I needed that, but that was okay. And the other lady, she took me under her wing and she was telling me about all the ins and outs I need to pay attention to in AA. And you know, we got to stay together as women and you got to know these things. So I thanked her for all that information. And then I found out later that she was turning tricks for the coffee. She didn't know it was free. So the third lady, I accepted as my sponsor. And then, not understanding what alcoholism was or the disease, so I went running around asking the people, I said, do you think that I'm an alcoholic? And they knew I was crazy, so they didn't say nothing to me. They let me go on. And I just kept asking, do you think that I'm an alcoholic? And so one afternoon, my sponsor got a little tired of me asking that question. So she said to me, well, Gloria, maybe by chance, you're not an alcoholic. I thought that lady was so brilliant that she saw all these great qualities I had and she recognized who I was. So she said, maybe by chance, you're not an alcoholic. Maybe you're just a drunken bitch. You know, that woman, she made me She made me so angry with her that I was determined that she would never, ever think that I would drink again. So I would follow her around everywhere she went. I would follow her to all these meetings, and I'd sit there, and I was angry to let her see that I'm not drinking, and you talk to me like that. Nobody talked to me like that. People didn't talk to me like that when I was drunk, and now you're talking to me like that. So one day, after doing this for about 6 weeks, I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholic Anonymous, and something said to me so silently and so sweetly that you haven't had a drink, have you? And I thought about that. No, I hadn't had a drink. And it said to me, you haven't needed a drink, have you? And no, I had not needed a drink. That was the day I sobered up in the fellowship of Alcoholic Anonymous. And you know, I know in our meetings, we say that the new people are the most important people here. And I agree with that because they let us know that the journey out there is still hard, it's still rough, and this disease is still killing. But I thank God for those people, those older people that stayed. Because if they had not stayed, who would have opened the door? When I was dying in this disease, where would I have went and who would have opened the door for me? I thank God for those three women that night because I realized that lady that had relapsed, she had more than I had at that time. She had hope. And the hope she had, she said, you know, I believe in this program. I believe if I keep coming back, if I keep doing what they asked me to do, that this program too could work in my life. I have hope in this program. And that, at that day, she had more than I had. And I thank God for her. That lady stayed sober, and I was able to walk with her in sobriety till the day she died, and she died sober. This program worked. That's an example of the beauty of this program that works in our life. That second lady that was sharing those things with me, I became aware that that's what we do for one another. We try to help save each other's life here. We try to give you whatever truth we have and hope that you can find it to be able to accept this journey of recovery and find that new life that you're seeking. I was grateful for those three women that stayed. And you know, this fellowship, I feel that I grew up in this fellowship one day at a time. And since they gave me at that meeting, though, that first meeting I went to, those people were very kind. They said to me that you don't have to die in this disease. You don't have to keep hurting and suffering and going through pain and shame in this disease. That there is a way out. And that way out is recovery. And they gave me the big book of Alcoholic Anonymous. And they said to me, now you go home and you read this book. And if you find anything in here that you can accept, then you come back to the meeting. But you know, either you come back to the meetings if you read the book, or you can die an alcoholic death in your disease. So they gave me an offer I couldn't refuse. Either I read the book or I died. So I decided I better read this book of AA. You know, this book is a journey to recovery. These 12 steps is a journey. It's a solution to our disease. It's a solution to the insanity. It's a solution to the darkness of our soul is in these 12 steps of this program. And you know, it's amazing because in these rooms, this program really is almost in two parts. The part of the fellowship, and we can become members of the fellowship because they keep telling us you make 90 meetings in 90 days and keep coming back. Or we can become members of recovery by reading the big book. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is in the big book. Unfortunately, some of us is in the fellowship, and we don't get into the book, you know. And, you know, through this journey to a new way of life that's given us in these 12 steps, some of the beautiful things that I found along the way. And we are the most different people that I've ever met in this fellowship. You know, we are the only people that name ourselves after a disease, you know? I didn't know whether my first name was alcoholic or my last name was alcoholic. We're the only people that name ourselves after a disease, and we can't find that in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm an alcoholic. So we're the only one that claim that we are the disease. And you know, in this program, I've met many people along the way. And some of the meetings I went to in AA, the guy was talking about, you know, I was an alcoholic and I was so low down that I had to buy a ladder to climb up to see the curb because of my alcoholism. I went to another meeting and the guy was talking about, I'm just a dope fiend, you know? And I thought about it. I have never heard anybody with cancer talk about, I'm a cancer fiend. I've never heard anybody talk about, I had to buy a ladder and climb up to see the curb because of my high blood pressure. I never heard anyone identify themselves as a disease. But again, like my partners here said, you know, I'm so grateful tonight to be here at the 80th anniversary of our program, that I was able to attend the conference they had in Toronto, Ontario, where Bill Wilson and Lois and some of those first 100 people were there. And at that conference is when Bill gave the first charge to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the charge he gave that where anyone, anywhere needed help, he wanted the hands of AA to be there, and for this we are responsible. I took that. We at that meeting took that charge seriously to know that we are responsible. And you know, each one of you tonight remind me of something I've heard along the way. It was about these years ago, and that was a farmer or a person that lived in the backwoods in the country. And in the country, they didn't have any cars, they didn't have any electricity, they didn't have any running water. But the father occasionally would walk to town. And his little son said to him, Daddy, next time you go to town, would you please let me go with you? And the father said, okay, I'll take you. So one day it came time for the father to go to town, and he told the little boy he could go. The little boy was so excited that he was able to go with his father that they started on this road, this long journey to town. And the little boy got tired along the way. And so he said, Daddy, I'm a little tired. So his father saw a little tree trunk, and he told his son, you sit here on this tree trunk, and Daddy will come back and get you. And he gave the little boy a light. He said, now you hold this light till Daddy come back for you. And the little boy said, okay. And the father went on down the road to town. Well, while the little boy was sitting there, there came people by, and they laughed at him. They made fun of him for him sitting there holding his light. And they called him names. And then when they passed by, the little boy just held the light. And after a while, it began to rain. It was a storm, and it rained on the little boy. And the little boy got soaking wet, but he held this light. And then it got dark outside. And in the darkness, there were shadows, and it frightened the little boy. But the little boy, he was sitting there shaking, holding the light. Then he looked down the road, and he saw this man coming. And he realized that it was his father. And the little boy ran up the road to his father, and he said to his daddy, he said, "Daddy, you know, there was people that came by, and they laughed at me, but I held the light." You know, your recovery is the light in this dark world. And you know, there will be times when people may talk about you, not understand you, and laugh at you while you're traveling this road of recovery, but hold the light. You know, sometime, like the little boy said, "Daddy, it rained on me, but I held the light." In our journey of recovery, there are going to be storms that's going to come in our life. There are going to be times when we feel like getting up and being discouraged and feeling like we can't make it another day. But in spite of that, we held the light. A guy in a program talked about what a good day was. He said, if you get up in the morning, you put on your clothes, you go to work, you do a good day's work, you go by your meeting, you call your sponsor, and you go to bed sober, that's a good night. And then there will come a time when you go to work, get up, put on your clothes, you go to work, and they tell you that your son died. And even though you heard that, you go to your meeting, you call your sponsor, and you go to bed that night, and that wasn't just a good night, that was a super night. That was something very special that we held on to our recovery. So even though it get dark in your life sometime, and you might get afraid, if you hold the light, your recovery is your light. It's the enlightenment that God has given you in a dark world, and you hold on to that recovery. And one day for me, I hope that when I take that step into eternity, that maybe when I meet my father along the way and I tell him that, "Father, they laughed at me at times. Father, it rained and I got afraid, but I held the light." And I hope my father would say to me, "Well, Gloria, you ran a good race and that was well done." My name is Gloria and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. But I'd like to say one thing Bill Wilson did. One thing Bill Wilson did at that conference. I have never saw it done in Alcoholic Anonymous since then. But Bill Wilson, there was over 10,000 people there. But he had us all stand up and hold hands and sang a song. And that song was, "It's No Secret What God Can Do. What He's done for others, He can do for you." And in your journey of recovery, you carry that message and realize that you are responsible. Thank you.
Gloria, thank you. All right, our final pioneer of AA, taking us back to 1956, is Joan.
I'm Joan. I'm an alcoholic. Back up? Okay. Yeah, the date of my last drink was June 15th, 1957. When I say that, a young woman came up to me one time several years ago, and she said, you know, that when you got sober, I wasn't even born yet. And then she said, well, neither was my mother. So I get a lot of that. I'm just glad to be above ground. My mother told me she never had any trouble with me till I was two. And it just kind of went downhill from there. How I got to Alcoholics Anonymous is really, I think, a short story in a way. I didn't even drink till I was 12 years old. I don't know how I lasted that long. But I was just one of those kids that was full of anger and fear and never talked to anybody about anything, you know. And somebody handed me a drink, and I took it. And I'm very grateful that's all I was ever handed, you know. But that was enough. It became my solution for my problem. My problem at that time was the fact that I couldn't stand thinking, and I couldn't stand feeling. And alcohol took care of that right away. And let's skip ahead. My husband left me when I was 22 years old, and I had three children. I was expecting a fourth. And I used to sit in my living room and blame that for the fact that I had to drink. And then I would think about my mother, who was an alcoholic, and my grandfather, who was an alcoholic. And that was why I drank. And they were just terrible people. They never thought about other people, didn't care about anybody, certainly didn't care about me. If they cared about me, they wouldn't drink. I had no clue. I had no idea that I had a drinking problem, because it wasn't a problem to me. I couldn't stand reality. And it was just all those kids. I didn't drink in the daytime because I knew I would get drunk. So I waited till I put them to bed. So of course I got putting them to bed earlier and earlier, but I would sit in the living room, and I would have my cigarette in one hand and my drink in the other. And then I would play my good alcoholic music, one by Judy Garland entitled Alone, and the other Frank Sinatra entitled No One Cares. Now, that was my fun drinking, you know. I was pathetic. It was just pathetic. But this is all, that was my whole world. I mean, here's all these babies, and what on earth, you know. So that was my solution. So I drank that way. Now, in January 1956, my grandfather died of chronic alcoholism. My mother was in the same condition, and they said she was going to die, but she didn't. And so about 3 months later, she called me in April. And she said, did I want to go to a meeting to see what helped her? And I thought, well, I haven't been out of the house for 7 years. I haven't been asked out for any place. So that's how I got to my first meeting, April 1956, in Pasadena, California. And so I went there to that meeting, and it was just it was fun. I mean, everybody was laughing and carrying on, but they were so old. I mean, I had just turned 24 years old. So, I mean, these people were 40, 50 years old. I mean, they were really old. You can see I've changed my attitude about that. But the thing was, they were so glad to see my mother. And I was impressed with that. Well, the thing of it was that some of you may not realize how much this means when you say this to people. But the few women that were there, there weren't a lot of women, said, please keep coming back. I thought, my gosh, they like me, you know. And I'd never been asked back anyplace because I just not a social drinker at all, very unsociable. And so anyway, so I went back to a meeting. Of course, well, then I didn't have a drinking problem because I wasn't an alcoholic. I didn't identify with anything. That isn't, I went because you were so nice. You were so kind. You wanted me to come. That's what I heard. And my mother was not drinking. I couldn't believe it. And so I kept going, but I also kept drinking. But then I would hear these women, and occasionally we had a woman speaker, and they would talk about, one would say that she'd been arrested 85 times on the corner of 5th and Town in Los Angeles. And one, she came out from back east. She'd been married 7-8 times, and she's married to one of Al Capone's men. And I know some of you don't even know who that is. But anyway, I did not identify with these people. And so I made, what I did is I listened for the differences. I listened for all the differences. I'm not an alcoholic because I'm not that old, of course. I'm not an alcoholic because I haven't been to jail. I'm not an alcoholic because I haven't only been married once, and thank heavens. And so, and the other thing is, I'm not Irish and I'm not Catholic. And I just used everything that I could to not say I'm an alcoholic. Because if that meant I said I was an alcoholic, then I couldn't drink. And I was so terrified of not having that, what I call my solution, to keep those feelings down and that thinking down. And because when I wasn't drinking, I was the kind of person in AA, they would say, give her a drink. You know, I was obnoxious. I am full of anger and full of fear. And so alcohol kept that down. And when I didn't have it, I just was angry, and I shouted a lot, and I just carried on. And so it wasn't easy because I didn't see, going to meetings and people laughing, I didn't see anything to laugh about. There wasn't anything to laugh about in my life, and it was they and them that got me here. You know, it was all their fault. And my first sponsor, my original sponsor, I remember her saying one time, she said, I can see you sitting in a bar when you're 80 years old, saying, if my parents hadn't divorced when I was four, you know. And so that was another thing I would throw in. But, of course, I've passed that age, too, already. but I wasn't a bar drinker anyway. But that was kind of my introduction. And then the next thing I know, they're going to take my kids away and lock me up somewhere. And so I thought, well, I don't think that's a good idea. So I decided to say I was an alcoholic. It relieved a lot of people's mind. But I didn't stop drinking right away. But I did change my area. And my home group became the Arcadia group in California. And that was the best thing ever happened to me because the one person there that we became very good friends, we used to go every place, not every place. We went a lot of places together and talked to groups across town, things like that. It was Norm Alpe, and he was been there about a year when I got there. So that was one of the best things that ever happened. And eventually, a series of things took place, but for some reason, and I don't know if there's any particular reason, that I took my last drink on June 15th, 1957. It was no different than the day before, as far as I remember. But I never intended to stay sober. That was the one thing I remember. Never intended to. It was because they're just after me, you know. And so my sponsor at that time, she said, well, you got to do service work. Well, she didn't. I thought they tricked me into things, because for a month I got to wash ashtrays, wash cups. I mean, this is terrible. But okay, I'll do that for a month, and then I'm drinking. So they just kept piling stuff on, you know, month after month. They just trick you in here. Newcomers, watch out. You may get sober in spite of yourself. But the one thing I remember to tell those of you that are new, to be a real alcoholic, what you have to have is a rotten attitude. Now, that I add. You cannot go any place in AA without a rotten attitude. So I had that one. And so anyway, I started doing that stuff. And temporarily, I was staying sober because I did not want to stay sober. And then after 2 years, all of a sudden I'm sober 2 years, and they make me secretary of this Arcadia group, which is very prestigious, if there is such a thing in AA. It was in my head at that time. You know how that is in those groups, you know. So there I was. And so then I thought, Alcoholics Anonymous needs me, you know. I mean, I don't care why you stay sober. It doesn't matter to me at all, just so you don't drink. And that's the way they treated me. It was just, I can't believe those people put up with me all those years. They'd pick me up, and I can't believe they put up with my whining and crying and shouting. But the initial thing that I might add to those of you that are fairly new, especially women that are younger and have children, because there weren't any people there that had young children. And when I did have my last drink, I was 25 years old, and they were just, no one, all their children were grown, or at least older teenagers, and that's one thing. These women, especially the women that didn't have children, would pat me on the head and say, "Now, honey, it's going to be all right." You know, like there's nothing to it. Just don't drink and all your problems are going to take care of themselves. And I looked around and looked at these four little problems, and I don't know how they were going to take care of themselves. But because when I had my last drink, my oldest was, it was 7 and almost 5 and 3 and a half and 2. That's how old they were. And nobody brought children to a meeting. You know, I had to have a babysitter. So they all kind of pitched in and got me to meetings. But what happened is another temporary is a big thing, in, it seems like, in my life, a lot of things, if I take it that way. Temporarily, this one woman said, "Well, why don't you do my ironing, and that'll give you a little money for pay babysitter." Because, see, I didn't say, but I didn't finish school. Left school when I was 16, no education, never had a job. I've been a little busy, you know, because when I got married, I was married 5 years, and in 5 years I had 4 children. I mean, I was pretty busy. So anyway, I started doing that to make money to pay for a babysitter, and then that kind of snowballed, and this one told this one, and this one told that one, and pretty soon they found a gold mine in me, and so I'm doing their ironing, and which is helping a lot, you know. And so, but this is just temporary till something else comes along. And that ironing lasted. I was doing like 7 days a week, you know, 12 hours a day, whatever it was, breaks to go to a meeting, you know. And I was doing that. That lasted temporarily for 13 years. And if I'd have known that, I don't think I'd have made it. But so see, what you don't know won't hurt you. So a lot of things in my life, if I'd just known what was ahead of me, so keep my nose right in front of me. And so anyway, that's how I lived in my Chinese laundry. But the thing of it was, I was kind of looked at like a switchboard of the San Gabriel Valley. Because I was always home, and I had, if you remember what telephones are, you know, those things, and I had a telephone with a shoulder thing and a 25-foot cord, and I sponsored women that would come in my Irene area, and they'd sit on the couch, and we'd do inventory. We'd, you know, do all kinds of stuff, study the book, and while I'm ironing and doing taking care of things all at the same time. So this way, what was it? It's just temporary. So anyway, this is, I don't want to get into another kind of an area, except that after 13 years that one of the women I was sponsoring, her husband was a CPA, and he said, I'm auditing this place of business and you ought to go up and see about it because the bookkeeper wants to retire. Well, I don't know anything, and I've never been in an office, so I went up there and told her, I don't know anything, and you don't want to hire me, do you? And she hired me. And so this is how I got into that career, if you will, the bookkeeper, and went on to be assistant to the controller, and a controller of a company downtown, the big Tishman building in Los Angeles, and so forth, and then and moved down to San Diego. So that I've got other things going on there after that. But what happened, at a few years sober, and my original sponsor was actually shot and killed by her boyfriend. And, you know, when you lose your sponsor like that, that's kind of tough. So I had a friend for a long time. Some of you might remember her. Her name is Sybil. And so she became now not just a friend, but my sponsor. And then I lived in Los Angeles by that time. And that was, what a history. You talk about a pioneer. She is history in itself, because she really was the first woman sober in Alcoholics Anonymous who stayed sober. And she has all the history from, you know, March 1st, 1941 when she came in. So it was a wonderful, wonderful experience, because I got to know all the guys that were at that time, the old timers. So she was just 16 years ahead of me. So, I mean, there wasn't any old timers. Was like, I thought about 5 years or 8 years or something like that. Was you're getting to be, wow, you're getting up there. But it's with this other, the thing about family and those of you that have had problems in your families and alcoholism and other than yourself. I've had a lot of it besides my grandfather and my mother. My daughter, one of my daughters has 23 years on the program. Two of her children, my grandchildren, are on the program. And I just got a text from my grandson, who's sober 3.5 years, and he just texted me a while ago, and he's so proud of me, you know, and all that sort of thing. And my granddaughter has, it's probably about going on 90 days, and these are not young kids. These two kids are 37, 38 years old. They've been suffering since in their teens. And what can I do? You know, you'd think I could help. No, you know I can't. And it's just been really, it's hard to watch. It's hard to watch with the family. But it's the fact that I came in when I did, around the people that I did, I got to meet the people and learn from them, and they taught me. They put up with me in the first place, and then they taught me all the things that I've needed to know one day at a time. And it's just, I can't tell you how grateful I am for not only what the fellowship has done for me. It taught me to love myself. You know, they love me till I can love myself, because I sure do for a long time, many years, really. It's really tough. But now, I would have missed all of that with my children are all good, you know. Let me tell you, my oldest one's 65 years old, and I don't think that's very funny. But anyway, what can you do? But they're all good. They're all good, and they think I'm great, you know. So here I am. I'm the only mother they got. So what can they do? But the privilege of being here is it's remarkable, you know, to have this experience and to be amongst all of you from all over the world. And I'm just another alcoholic, and I haven't had a drink for 58 years, and that's one day at a time. one day at a time. That's all that any of us do it. That's all any of us do it. So don't ever get mixed up. Don't ever get mixed up with this thing, oh, you know, put us up here or something. We do it the same way you do, one day at a time. And I'm so grateful for you having me and allowing me to share my sobriety with you. Thank you.